And you drove up this morning?
Yeah, just drove in.
From Hillsborough.
Right now.
Yeah. Okay, you're going to sit there.
Well, wherever it's convenient. Where,
yeah, this
where
way.
Well, it was, sitting right there,
yeah,
is fine.
Good.
And I'll sit over here.
Okay.
And I have this because I think Vic is talking about you for something. And I need to verify that. At some point here.
Yeah.
Vic and I had a great relationship.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Did you work directly for him?
No.
Or did you just, because
I worked directly for Neil Goldschmidt,
yeah, exactly,
for 4 years.
Yeah, exactly.
With Victor, he... Well, of course, we knew each other a long time while they were in the Senate together.
Right.
And Dolores and I antiqued together.
Oh, great.
We'd take off on all-day jaunts.
Uh-huh.
I'd drive, and she'd bring the fancy lunch.
Yeah.
And we antiqued together, the four of us, at the fairgrounds all the time,
uh-huh,
you know, when it was,
yeah,
there. And so he is the first one that brought me into state government in commission positions.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
he appointed me to the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board,
mm-hmm,
and then moved me from there to the Liquor Commission.
Okay.
So I was a liquor commissioner for,
yeah,
5 years.
Yeah. When did he put you on the Fair Dismissal Board? Was it early
but
in
it
his
would
term?
Have been 79 or 80, because I think I went on the Liquor Commission in 81.
Okay. Denny Miles tells about finally, you know, he's hot stuff. He's working for the governor. His father, for the first time, finally respects him. And lo and behold, he gets a phone call very early on, 79, from a reporter saying, so tell me about the head of the fair that got fired. And Denny has no clue in the world who this guy is talking about. He gives a very flippant answer. And hangs up the phone and 5 minutes later calls back and says, what do I need to do so you won't publish that? I can keep my job. Oh!
Learning the ropes.
Learning the ropes. Learning the ropes.
Learning the ropes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. No, we had lots of great fun with him. I was reminding Mike of this trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually found it. They were out antiquing. We'd pick them up at their house,
mm-hmm,
and it was before Mahonia Hall.
Yeah.
So we picked him up, and we went out, and I found this trunk. Well, I think we were living in, I don't know if it was a special session, and we were living in a hotel room or something, and so they stored the trunk for a long time. I,
mm-hmm,
refinished it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was able to come down in a pickup truck to bring it back, they said, gee, we'd sure like to keep that trunk. And I said, sorry.
It's going away.
Yeah, it's coming with us.
Yeah.
It's coming with
that
us.
That trunk's old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So what was the quote that was,
well, let me play it for
me?
You. Let me play it for you.
Okay.
So turn this on. Sure, everything's talking to each other here. So this is Victor in March a year ago.
You would know her, but her husband is a senator. I know very well. He was very well known, nice guy, I like him. She went to work for my successor.
Mm-hmm.
A few months after I saw her, she said, this job is tougher than you made it look. And I that's a particularly,
mm-hmm,
highlight.
That's a very telling and wonderful.
But there was another one.
So did you say that? Okay. That's all the verification I need. That may become the title of the book. It's just sums up,
yeah,
what so many people say about Vic, that, yeah, he was so engaged, he was so accessible, and I know I've interviewed both Barbara and Ted, yeah, and they say basically the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, getting in there, they tried to do what Vic did with weekly staff meetings and,
yeah,
stuff, and it's like,
yeah,
and partly it's the time to change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, I know with Neil, and I want to talk to you a little about Neil. I know with Neil, you know, he came in with, he was sure about things and doing things, and but he didn't have experience with that kind of state,
right,
government.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He was the mayor of a city.
That's right.
You know, he
not
was a secretary. He just wasn't a Salem person.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, I can remember he set that 100-day agenda. And Vera Katz, this was Neil, Vera Katz said afterwards, he just didn't understand the process, and you don't do it when 100 days in Salem.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. But he was a fast learner also.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm discovering some people found him so frustrating because they couldn't get access like they'd gotten access to Vic.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to John Junker yesterday, Budget's Dan Simmons, who said he's been out here, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys, you know, the top of the bureaucracy, they said they had access to him whenever they needed it. And so it's just an interesting
Different change. Style, a little different style, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, tell me about Victor Tia from your point of view. When were you elected?
I was elected to the state senate in 1972.
Okay.
So the first session would have been the 73 session.
Right.
And you know, fairly young, you know, this youngster from Eastern Oregon.
I've already talked to Earl Blumenauer, who was 23, so.
So, elected in 73, actually went to Salem not knowing anybody or anything, and yet thought I knew a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens to a lot of people that are first elected. Actually was appointed after the Senate organized to chair a committee.
Mm-hmm.
And that was seen as, my goodness, this freshman senator given a committee.
Yeah.
And it's interesting thinking about Victor Tia and thinking about the interface with and on a fast learning curve to get to know the process and the people.
Mm-hmm.
It became apparent to me, and maybe this is the advantage of going in without a lot of preconceived notion, a lot of experience, that if you're going to be able to provide any kind of leadership, you certainly needed to be bipartisan.
Right.
And that was I look at the situation today compared to then, and my analysis or my reaction is it's become much more partisan.
Yeah.
When I was first elected at a committee and I assigned Republicans and Democrats various roles in the committee, and a lot of that was, I think, a byproduct of people like Victor Tia. You know, he was a leader in the Republican Party in the Senate, and that was encouraged. You know, the bipartisanship was encouraged. But you know, from there, I became, you know, very, very, very cognizant of Vic's style, and it maybe fit in somewhat to my approach, and that is, he was always, you know, willing to listen and understand. He was not a dominant type of a leader, but he certainly knew how to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And for an example, you had mentioned here just a few minutes ago his style as governor and his regular meetings. Well, to me, that symbolizes a leader that depends upon top people running various agencies or department, and you constantly need to be in touch with them, and you constantly need to be making sure that everybody knows what's going on. Contrast that with styles of most recent governors. Well, we have a new governor now, but dropping back to a Kitzhaber, there was a migration away from that style to a type of management that you would have within the governor's office, a staff person who was in charge of, say, natural resources, or a staff person in charge of corrections or education or whatever. So you build up a situation where you almost had a staff person that was giving direction to a person that was running an agency.
Mm-hmm.
Vic's style was the chief executive officer, if you will, role, if you can use that example, whereby the people that were in charge of making the daily decisions in an agency were reporting to the leader, and he could give direction. And I particularly like that approach, as opposed to another layer of people who give direction. I mean, it seems to me the governor should give direction to the people in charge of the agencies. Why would you hire them if you didn't respect their leadership? I like that style of leadership. I learned that early on in watching Vic and Tia. And, you know, as Jill has pointed out, we respected them so much. They're just great people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. In the Senate, did you have direct dealings with him? I mean, in 73, things are going well, but then all of a sudden he's the leader of a caucus that...
They met in the phone booth.
Yeah, Wally Carson with glee showed me his poster-sized picture of the phone booth.
Yeah.
And then when they were seven, Vic actually had made little gold Roman numeral seven pins.
Yeah.
So there's only seven of them in the world. I've seen three of them so far. but did you interact with him as that happened?
Let's put it this way. I never discontinued, and I always say this right, we always continued to react, get along. And I saw, and I would say it today, I think the best government comes out of a situation when the parties are, you know, when the members of each party are very, very balanced.
I think,
you know, there's in the Senate, a 14-16-16-14 split is much better than a 30, you know, a 20-10 or something like that. So, but I think, you know, it's hard to recall everything, but I think back when there was just seven, there was pressure on them. You could feel that. There was this sort of, well, why does it matter? You know, we're not going to do anything anyway. But I never really felt like I paid a lot of attention to that. And I think the major reason was the area that I represented, Eastern Oregon, rural Oregon, you know, it was then clearly a resource-based economy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a natural resource-based economy. Vic Attia understood that very well. Bob Smith was in the state senate from Burns. And, you know, there was about four of us that basically had, you know, all of Eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
And so while the numbers, I was a Democrat, while our numbers were higher, I don't think I ever really took great stock in that from the perspective of what I needed to do for the constituents I represented.
Right. So the geography and the resources becomes a more important.
That was always the case.
Yeah.
That was always the case. And you hear it today, you know, rural Oregon versus, you know, metropolitan Oregon. I think it's become more strident today, that gap.
Vic on the, in 73, was he on the committee that dealt with Senate Bill 100?
I actually was on his committee, in the Education Committee. He was not on the committee that dealt with Senate Bill 100, but he chaired the Education Committee, and there was Senate Bill 1 and 2, which was a byproduct of an interim report. I'll never forget that. And you know, he worked diligently trying to get that passed. I don't believe much came of it, as I recall, that was...
Yeah. I think with Senate Bill 100, I think in maybe 75, he was on the committee that dealt with what do you do for implementation.
That's right, he was.
Somebody I talked to vividly remembered, it was actually McCall came in.
Yeah.
Said, get something done.
Yeah.
And so the chair of the committee said, well, let me explain to you why we can't get it done now.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I moved with us to the floor. And they went through. Attia? No.
Yeah.
And it was split.
Yeah.
You know, he clearly couldn't move out of committee at that point.
Yeah.
So McCall.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I know that as we have later found with 100, the devil's always in the details.
Yeah.
It was an idea, and I actually supported 100.
Mm-hmm.
I was supporting from the perspective of, I thought it was a way of sort of protecting the integrity of farmland,
right,
and rangeland. Right. You know, I was coming from that perspective. As we've since learned, and over time as court cases and it's evolved, it's become a very burdensome issue for certain development. And in fact, many rural communities lack the resources back in the very beginning stages to properly set out zones and boundaries, and now they can't do much because they put a boundary in place back in 73 or 4 or 5, whatever, that really constrains what they can do today. And there's mm-hmm. been follow-up efforts to try to modify that. But anyway, Vic was not on the original committee.
Original.
Yeah. He also supported it, but, you know, he fundamentally, he wanted to know all the facts, but that didn't mean it was going to move him.
Yeah.
But he supported it, and he supported the idea.
Yeah.
When you were going to their house in the West Hills, the Beaverton Hillsdale Highway right down mm-hmm. there, their family farm is where they're now a Fred Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the boys had grown up there forever, mm-hmm. and then the boys, you know, live all within half a mile of each mm-hmm. other. But they watched that little two-lane country road turn into a five-lane highway with strip mm-hmm. malls.
Dolores
and Vic
hated
just
Fred
said,
Meyer.
That can't be.
Yeah.
So, you know, right. he supported the supported the idea as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Just watching.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The people who were in the Senate at that time, in the Republican side, talk about being effective in committees. And then Wally Carson was funny when they had six. He said Jason Bowe assigned them to so many committees, Wally had one free hour a week. And his wife was sitting much like you, because she was his staff.
Right.
And she said, oh, it was horrible. but did you see that effectiveness in committees with them?
Yeah, I thought, notwithstanding the numbers,
mm-hmm.
you know, Tony Meeker.
Yeah.
Very, very effective. I worked with Tony very closely, good friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hector McPherson was a, you know, a name that was George Wingard, you know, mm-hmm. Wally Carson,
mm-hmm.
you know, Bob
Stan
Smith.
Stan Outerkirk.
You know, they must have been effective. I can still remember the names.
Yeah.
No, they were all, very active in trying to represent the interests of their
okay.
constituency.
Yeah.
And, you know, some credit, no doubt, has to go to their leader at the time, too,
uh-huh.
Vic Tia.
Mm-hmm.
But, the first committee I chaired, Outerkirk and Meeker were on it, and Tony took over drafting a pesticide registration deal, and Stan took over some guidance on commercial fishery and the fishery,
mm-hmm.
and you know, we developed, you know, because they had expertise. I didn't
yeah.
know anything about that really,
yeah.
and so we turned to them right off the start. And
yeah.
maybe some of the Democrats might have asked, well, "Why'd you do that?" Well, we needed smart people trying to help figure this stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you do any work on or you know, cheering on the sidelines for the 1974 gubernatorial campaign, Straub or Attia?
You know, I'm trying to remember. I don't think we were very active. I mean, I wasn't out supporting openly
mm-hmm.
Attia for sure, and I don't remember.
Except I think we did take him to the Joseph Rodeo.
Yeah, I think when they were here, they'd
mm-hmm. stayed in this home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was in 74.
Okay.
But we were not actively campaigning for
yeah.
Straub
yeah.
either.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can get away with that being a Democrat in Eastern Oregon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
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 And the straw people knew that too, so.
Yeah.
In 78, were you playing a role there? As I mean, that's just the fascinating on the Republican side, you know, Roger Martin and Vic, and then McCall gets in.
Yeah.
And someone described it really wonderfully, you know, as McCall was leaving office, there was already the full-grown myth of McCall.
Yeah.
And he found out that even McCall couldn't measure up to it in 1978.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's that, and then we go into the general where this is the last time a sitting governor's been beaten.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think by that time, you know, McCall was governor when I was first elected, and, you know, contrasting McCall with Roger Martin and with Vic Atiyah, Vic clearly, in my mind, had a better, I related better to his style of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tom McCall was flamboyant. He was, you know, mm-hmm. an idea person.
Mm-hmm.
He had. You know, he was surrounded by some good people.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what I think. In fact, we were laughing about the time the whale got washed up on the beach and because people went down with dynamite to blast it off and blew whale all over the country.
Which, just so you know, had resonance when Victor wanted to go blow up the sign at the California border.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
The whale was still fresh in people's memories, as well as, I don't know if you know, there's a story down there, the D'Autremont brothers held up a train down in the tunnel there
okay.
and blew it up.
Okay.
So there would have been, you know, they were afraid of sign...
Yeah.
like the whale, with all the television cameras there.
So. I wasn't aware of that story.
Just like, but
that's
when
a good one.
That was when the Lee, the chief of staff, who eventually left, that's the first time he said he had to use Denny.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Denny, your friend, talk him out of this!
But when they would come this way,
mm-hmm.
I think probably we tended to see more of Vic Atiyah during that campaign.
Yeah.
As we were running. And,
yeah.
you know, if they came to town or in the area, we certainly would try to, identify things we're going to show them, introduce
right.
them, whatever.
Right.
You know, this notion, because they happen to be another party or something, you should ignore them is nonsense. How else, and I can relate to some things that Vic Atiyah did when he was governor that had me, you know, had we been sort of standoffish
mm-hmm.
posture, wouldn't have happened. You know, I recall later on when there's now the Eastern Oregon Correctional Facility.
Right.
At one time it was a mental hospital, an
yeah.
MRDD facility. And there'd been pressure to close that for years, and the activists wanted to close it, and obviously it had a big impact on the community,
mm-hmm.
and we could see sort of the handwriting on the wall. It looked to me like eventually it was going to get downsized, and the trend to put people out on the
yeah.
street and normalize, which now is probably the source of a lot of homelessness,
mm-hmm.
and you can look at the after effects. But at the time, Governor Atiyah then, actually at our request for some help, by executive order, created a task force that we participated with that come up with a interim strategy that actually put a smaller facility in place that served the needs of Eastern Oregon, 13 counties, for many years thereafter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was because we tried to, you know, whenever an official come, we tried to talk about what's going on here. And,
yeah.
And he was very responsive to that. It fit his style of management
mm-hmm.
right to the T. And so, you know, I credit him with providing some answers at a time when, you know, the activists were stridently in one camp and
yeah.
and the defenders of the status quo in the other, and, you know, what happened to the folks you're trying to take care of? You know, turn them out, put them on the street, whatever, downside, no. Because facilities to accommodate that, as was the case in our example of Senate Bill 100, the resources
mm-hmm.
to do the right zoning
right.
weren't provided. And in this case, if you're going to normalize or create home, where's the homes you put them in? No,
yeah.
we don't have the money
yeah.
for that,
yeah.
but we're going to close down. Well, Vic Atiyah was very good at seeing through that kind of stuff and giving great credit for so much of his management style was understand the issue, understand the problem, try to do the right thing, and and that as much as, you know, he was as good as at that as anyone that's been governor.
I just, a couple of weeks ago, I grew up in Medford, and my dad was at 100th birthday of a former mayor of Medford, a guy named Lou Hannum, not Len Hannon, but Lou Hannum. Vic was down there in, I think, 1981, and he gave a speech. This is right when they're putting in the DEQ testing stations. So they got him there. Medford's got the worst air anywhere. So. And Vic gave a speech that I hope I can find the original of that really not very well considered. It's, and in it, he said things like, if I lived here, I wouldn't put up with this stuff. And Lou Hannum, who was on the city council at that point, wrote him a letter taking him to task and laying out what was going on and, and this stuff, which led Vic to a conversation. And Vic got this guy together with the head of the DEQ. And Vic backed this guy up. The DEQ wanted to do kind of a wacky experiment. But it's Vic, you know, wow, if I'm wrong, tell me. Let's get the facts. Let's get this out here. And so it's really great. And this guy, he's blind now at age 100. Jeez Louise. But his daughter went and found all the original letters. So. It's exactly that kind of thing.
Very, very, his style of leadership is, you know, is unique in a political position.
No ego.
Yeah, which drove Denny nuts.
Yeah.
You have to take credit for these things. But you do what you do.
Right.
Conversation we had last night. What'd you ask? Who's going to write my memoirs? That's the last on my list.
There you go.
Heck.
Well, this is great because Vic asked me. So.
Did he?
Yeah.
That's. I was going to ask you how you became involved in this.
Well, he, over the past 4 years, has been giving all his stuff to Pacific. So we've got the archive.
Right.
And I was along for the first probably half dozen meetings. Because they would, Vic, unlike most archives, you pack everything up in boxes and send it over. Vic, you would go to his office and he'd give you a box. Which is fun because then he'd tell stories about what the box. And so I went over for the first probably six times.
Six boxes.
And they recorded stuff as I asked questions and probe. And but after we had a big opening of the archive in October of 2013.
We were not able to attend, but we were invited.
It was great. And about a week and a half later, we went over to just kind of debrief and tell him things, and that's when he asked me. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying it?
It's a blast. It's a blast. My professional life is kind of half international stuff and half American stuff. And so with all his Taiwans and Syrias and things, it's great.
Well, I laughed when I went to work for Neil and had such a great relationship with Victor. It is the first time probably that a Lebanese leader was followed by a Jewish leader and we didn't have a war.
Exactly. And I actually have a picture from 1983 at the National Republicans Conference. John Sununu from New Hampshire is the second Arab American. And then Sununu goes and he's the chief of staff for Bush and stuff like that. Big, big deal. But I've got a picture of them together, and I'm I would love to know if they even talked about it. Because for the political side, Vic's Arab American identity was never a part of it at all.
No, and he was upfront about it, too. I mean, he would tell people he wasn't hiding it at all.
Yeah, he wasn't hiding it, but it was just never an issue.
Yeah, never an issue.
Denny never polled for it in the campaigns. Nothing.
Interesting. Well, we're divorced. I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to follow up on that, too. Has anyone talked to you very much about the Oregon Trail study that he had done, commissioned?
No.
Okay. So that was my other connection with him, but I didn't know it was going to work out that way. But I, after I left state government, when Neil didn't run again, Steve Corey, who lives here in Pendleton, asked me to chair the statewide sesquicentennial of the Oregon Trail. Well, it was all started by Vic. He commissioned a study, and then a plan was developed. So he saw the sesquicentennial coming in 93, probably 8 years before.
Yeah.
And his love of history and his love of Oregon and what the Oregon Trail meant to Oregon. Well, Steve chaired the committee that did this study.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking for the plan, and I think I loaned it out when they did the Oregon, sesquicentennial of statehood, because they were trying to figure out what kind of a statewide celebration they were going to have, and they wanted my book. But if that hadn't been commissioned way ahead by Vic, we wouldn't have had very much going on in 1993.
Yeah.
So that was another thing where he loved the whole state and wanted it all tied together, and it had the research done so then they could present it and have someone then carry it out. So there was a commission appointed, we set it up as a nonprofit, but the roots were with Vic.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's, his whole love of history had such a big impact on his life, the antiquing kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
His brothers didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And his older, one of his twin brothers is still alive, so I've talked to Ed several times. The collecting of guns, Vic did not.
Yeah.
But it was the history.
Mm-hmm.
That's the history was what it was all about, and it's really cool to shoot muzzle loaders and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just so many things like that. That love of history turned into
something that benefited the state.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
His connection with the Native American community again. It's
huge, particularly the Warm Springs.
Yeah.
But I mean, with all the tribes.
Yeah. Do you know how that started?
Fishing, I think.
Fishing's part of it. I mean, he prided himself on, in fact, we have it in the archive now, he had a lifetime fishing pass for the Warm Springs.
Loved
he also, in fact, at the same time when he asked me to write the book, he was showing us his fishing licenses from when he was governor. When you're governor, your fishing license is 00001. 1987. Whatever it is, 3,292. That's how you tell.
Suddenly no one cares.
Suddenly no one cares. I got an interesting lead on this because in about 73, there's the creation of the Legislative Indian Commission.
Yeah, okay.
And Vic was the one who was, it's his bill.
Okay, his I remember it passing. I didn't connected, but that
and so that's great. That advances me from that gets me another 10 years from where I was before.
Mm.
And there's a hypothesis that it was through Sam Johnson.
Okay,
because Sam Johnson is. I was at. Have you ever been to Roger Martin's old timers gatherings?
Yeah, they just had one last
week. I was there. So, people saying, Sam Johnson saved his bacon by getting the federal government to buy his mill. But if that's the case, then that takes, because Vic and Sam were doing a lot of things together.
Yes.
That may get me back to 67 at least.
Okay.
This will have to talk to Betsy and see if she remembers anything about
that. Yeah.
Maybe Bob Smith would know.
I've talked to Bob and he's not, he's really good on things that really still tick him off. But he's not.
Yeah.
These interviews usually last kind of an hour to an hour and a half, and I was done with him in 25 minutes.
Yeah.
The things that take him off, still the kicker. My God, that was the best thing in the world because it kept government spending money, and then the balanced budget amendment in the in Congress, because that was his his name was on that.
Yeah.
He's still ticked off at Mark Hatfield.
Yeah.
But he's he's beyond those kinds of memories.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Tony Meeker?
I haven't talked to him yet.
Yeah.
Haven't talked to him yet. But I mean, so many people knew Vic in, you knew this part or this part or this part. So finding the one that might know the Native American
yeah,
part.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe the Native Americans would know.
Yeah, yeah, and I've got a couple of connections to try to get in there. So yeah. Although, you know, as you know, that's a harder nut to crack.
Yes. Yeah.
They've got to buy into you as well.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an enormous regard for him within that community, within the Native American. And as Jill said, the Warm Springs connection would be the place where I would think you could go first.
Yeah,
he definitely had a good relationship with Antone out here in Minthorne. But, but I don't remember the names of the ones that he was really close to at Warm Springs.
Yeah, no, I have several names.
Okay.
And I've done some stuff with the tribe, so it turns out somebody I worked with like 7 years ago is a key person.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what we can get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right. I mean, the basic thing is Vic just loved to go to the Deschutes and go fishing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
And he was really helpful with them in establishing that museum over there.
Yeah, the museum. The thing that Ted Kulongoski was saying, which he then saw, you know, in working when Ted was the Attorney General,
mm-hmm.
was the Sovereign to Sovereign meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Vic started that in about 82.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just elevated him.
Yeah.
In a big, big way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So Victor becomes governor, 78, comes into office in 79. That 79 session has been described as kind of the high point of Oregon budgets and kind of the end of that activist 70s period. In fact, Ted Kulongoski and I were discussing that 70s period is when the legislature was truly a co-equal part of the government.
Mm-hmm.
The last time we see the legislature really generating policy and moving things is probably Kitzhaber's health plan in the 90s, the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a responsive place now. It's not mm-hmm. it's not generating things.
Right.
But 79, so you know the money's coming in, things are there. But California's Proposition 13 hanging over people's heads. There's been measures 6 and 10, the property tax measures,
mm-hmm.
on that 78 ballot. And then, so everybody eventually goes home. We have a kicker. We give back millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to taxpayers. And then Paul Volcker says we need higher interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
After everybody's gone home.
Right.
So what do you remember about the shift from Oregon being, you know, a place where the budgets are okay and we're doing fine, we got to worry about this property tax thing, to all of a sudden we begin to hit a series of recessions that peak with that 1982?
Well, memory's a little fuzzy.
That's fine, that's fine. So
but
even as I was talking to Vic, I was saying, Vic, geez, I wish you'd asked me 15 years ago.
You know, at a macro level, if you connect Oregon and the economic slide that you're referring to, it clearly ties into, in my mind, a resource-based economy then. Wood products was still critical to Oregon's economy. Of course, the agriculture, but interest rates started to soar, and you know, I recall as a farmer,
mm-hmm.
some of the borrowing rates we had to pay for money was just unbelievable. The pressures that created, so we hit a situation where the nature of our economy was exceedingly sensitive to high interest rates,
mm-hmm.
and it basically put the brakes on the growth and the expansion and the operation. I mean, if interest rates are through the roof, who's going to buy lumber to build a house?
Right.
It's those kinds of connections that that I recall. And as a farmer, when interest rates were pushing up better than 15%, pushing 20% in some cases,
yeah.
How can you afford to borrow money to operate the farm?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's that kind of dynamic. And so, you know, high interest rates to a person that had a passbook savings account, that was gravy.
Yeah, yeah.
But to an economy that is so resource-based oriented,
mm-hmm.
as we were then, high interest rates just put the brakes on. And, you know, I recall special session and 10% cuts and another special session and another 10% cut. The one thing I do recall in all of that was Vic Atiyah was probably the one person that should have been in charge at that time, because he knew how to manage the adversity that we're going through as well as anybody I think we've had. He was very, very good at, again, this chief executive management style that I think he possessed, at working through each of the agencies and working through the solutions. And, you know, it was a tough time. But Vic didn't go out on the street and cry and doom and people will be dying and, you know, that kind of stuff. Vic figured we had to find a way to manage through this. And I thought he did a, you know, as good a job as anyone could do. Post Major 5, if you recall, some of the comments by then the governor, you know, this will put people on the streets and there will be people, I think, dying on the streets or something, as I recall. Well, that wasn't Vic's style. Vic's style was, you know, take the situation you've got, work your way through it, do the best you can, and so I give him, you know, kudos. I remember, of course, I was then working my way in through on the Ways and Means Committee and the budget stuff, and so we lived with that, you know, day in and day out. Never revenue forecast was worse than the previous one. It was tough times, but, you know, and, you know, you learn from those things, and I think Oregon learned the importance of beginning to diversify some of its economic base. You know, obviously the tech industry started to diversify some of that, particularly on the west side. Eastern Oregon still struggles today, relatively speaking. But you know, you learn from those situations, and I give Vic a lot of credit for trying to help manage the transition. I'll just continue here. I recall when I actually chaired Ways and Means Committee, one of his budgets called for some additional effort in the for the Economic Development Department, was then called. And of course, I from this side, you know, wheat, you know, 85-90% of our production goes in some market internationally. You know, it's not consumed.
I give talks around the state and say, you want to know who knows international relations? Let me introduce you to the East Side farmers.
This is our lifeblood. And so I had an opportunity working with then Governor Atiyah and his budget people to start an expansion of the state's interest in offices in Asia. And we got the office in Japan, and later, you know, expanded into Taiwan and I think Korea and so on. You know, Vic, although it wasn't specifically contained in his budget, in working with him, again, the example you used about the person in Medford working with him, it became abundantly clear that this made an enormous amount of sense. And he became a champion of trying to expand trade and you know, later on, you know, had the nickname, I think, Trader Vic. But
I met the person who coined the phrase, actually.
Yeah. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is he was a hands-on kind of manager. He tried to understand the problems, and he you know, in my mind, that was great leadership. There are governors who think we'll come up with this grandiose idea, and then that's leadership. Well, good ideas are important, but you better have taken enough time to figure out how the grand idea is going to become reality and what the implications are. And you know, you contrast leadership styles, and you look at the theory of Senate Bill 100. It started with this grandiose, oh my goodness, we can't have this expansion and development and that sort of thing. And the devil obviously is in the details. How do you work that through?
Yeah.
I've rambled a lot here, but we've strayed from, you know, things are great and we had excess funds to a sudden change. And And you mentioned Paul Volcker. Yes, when the Fed started changing the interest rate, Oregon was exceedingly sensitive to that kind of a dynamic. Mm-hmm. You know, we still saw what happened in the last economic recession when, you know, a state that depends upon the income tax for the bulk of its revenue is going to have cycles much more extreme than a state that has a more fixed base like a sales tax or whatever. That's a given, and Oregonians continue to live in the world.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
we're going to stick with it.
We're going to stick with it. And that played into the economic challenges we had in the late 70s, early 80s. When interest rates drove businesses to shut down, income taxes to the state went down, we compounded our problem as a result.
Yeah. On Ways and Means, Pat Amodeo tells of at some point, Vic said, okay, nobody can go and testify about budget stuff and vary from the numbers that I've given you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she says you kept her in the chair once for 7 or 8 hours. And it was all on the closed circuit TV, so she knew the boss could look and see she was doing her job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I completely bought into and respected the fact that the governor's recommended budget was the document that you worked from. And there was nothing that would prevent the governor from coming back and revising the recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the challenges that we were trying to work through, and this is what's difficult from the governor's side, very difficult. You start putting your budget again and finalize it in September before the legislature comes in January.
Yeah.
And then the legislature has the luxury of a couple of revenue forecasts, a March forecast, a May forecast, and the numbers change.
Yeah.
And so now you've got a governor's recommended budget cast in a fairly strict order back, 6-8 months. It starts a year in advance, really. And then the legislature has the luxury of looking at changing numbers. And so then there's a temptation on the part of the legislature to start, you know, moving program and moving things. And if you're going to stick by this, you know, the script of the governor's recommended budget, and then you've got more revenue, or maybe you've got less, but usually it's more revenue when when you start looking at making the changes. It puts a lot of pressure on the governor's office, particularly when they're standing there saying, this is our budget, this is the numbers we have, and we know that the numbers are different. So what do you do with what's in between?
Right.
That's a quandary that, that exists today. You know, they've got more money, and so the legislature is in the process of spending more money. But I, at the end, I felt the governor's approach, you have to hold the agencies accountable, that's his management style, and they come in to defend the governor's budget, and that's the way it should be. I think always been, and I know in the case I was using in the market development and international trade, it was, you know, while it was not originally totally scripted in the governor's budget, changing it on our part was with his approvals, basically.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you know, just to Pat Amodeo feeling like I was torturing her, it's interesting. As time passes, I'll be the first to admit, I think as a legislature, you over the years you realize what you probably didn't know that you thought you knew when you first started. You know, at a young 30-year-old, I thought I had ever figured out, and, you know, 15 years later, well, maybe it's not quite as easy as it looks.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Did you ever go on any of those trade missions?
I later ran the Port of Portland, spent a bunch of time in that role.
Right.
Using those offices and using the ports connect mm-hmm. with those offices mm-hmm. and I don't know how many thousands of miles I traveled doing that. When Vic was governor, I don't recall going on any mission with him. Now, maybe my memory's hazy and maybe there was one. I don't recall.
He did a lot of them.
He did a ton of stuff. Yeah. And remember, after he left office, he did a lot.
Well, he went on the first one Neil went on.
Yeah, and he was on that one, and I was on that one.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
What I remember about that one as much as any, we were in Taiwan, and there was a bunch of Oregon business representatives on the trip.
Uh-huh.
And three or four people went out to jog, and they got lost, and they got back to the hotel finally in the middle of the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And the lesson you learn from that, when you leave the hotel in a foreign country and the street signs you don't understand, take a business card with you so you can give it to a taxi cab driver to get you back.
Take breadcrumbs.
But
Vic has a funny story from after he left the governorship and he's doing his consulting business. He was over talking to his friends in Japan. And during the day, unlike when he's governor, his schedule when he was governor was stunning.
Yeah.
When he would be doing that. He'd have like major things. He could easily have 20 major things. And when you counted them, he had like 67 things total in a day. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
So when he's consulting, he's dinner and golf are the key things, and then you do talks.
And
And so across from his hotel, there was this really neat neighborhood in Tokyo. And so he spent 3 days during these kind of free afternoons kind of wandering through there, and it was really, you know, got some souvenirs and just a great time. And at the dinner on the last night, he was telling people, yeah, this is what I've been doing. They were appalled. It's a red light district. And they said, well, I wish you hadn't told me that. No one came up and propositioned me.
That's a great story.
That's a great story.
It's classic Vic.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.
Let's talk going from Vic to Neil. How long are you in the legislature? Are you in the legislature when Neil's in and then he appoints you to the port?
Well, actually, yes and no. I left the legislature in 91.
Okay.
And went to the port. So
okay,
Neil...
So
Neil was still governor. The port actually, the commission actually selects the executive director, not the governor doesn't appoint. Now, I don't know if there was a conversation between the governor and the commission. That I couldn't even come close to answering that.
Right.
I don't know. But
when you watch Mr. Wyatt walk in, though, you sense that the governor is involved somehow.
Yeah, I think that's become more, I think the port, very honestly, has become more politicized now than it was,
mm-hmm.
much more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm not sure that's for the best.
Yeah.
But that's my honest, candid take, that it's become much more politicized, that it was... When I felt was there, the political pressures from the state of Oregon, governor's office, whatever, were far removed.
Right.
And
right.
we were trying to understand the port's mission, the development of trade opportunities, and there were times when clearly, we had some issues with the governor's office
mm-hmm.
over regulation or whatever the case may be. I don't know that that's quite that way today.
It's hard to tell. Actually, when you left, I actually applied.
What the heck?
Because I do international economics and trade. I mean, that's actually the first time I talked to Vic. Not for that, but I was at the University of Portland for years.
Yeah.
And resigned and trying to figure out what to do and went and talked to Vic because Vern Duncan's a good friend. Vernon.
Yeah.
And Vic and I talked for an hour and a half or something. He said, well, if I were governor, you'd be the head of my economic development.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like, good. Yeah. Okay. You told Governor Kulongoski that? But yeah, just watching the court is just fascinating.
Yeah.
Just fascinating. It's still, how do you balance it as basically 19th century trade with 21st century? I mean, we need the 19th century trade for the wheat and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, then you get caught up in what they're, you know, they're in right now. We're just a teeny tiny little player.
Yeah.
And that's why the shippers
pulled out.
Said, you know, it's just a little too much trouble.
Well,
so,
you know, we've always been a little player.
Yeah.
But we were a player.
Yeah.
And the port made a decision to become less of a player and farm out that terminal.
Yeah.
And when they did that,
yep.
when they did that, they wrote the script that mm-hmm. ultimately was followed, and the shippers pulled.
Yep.
You can be a small player, but you can be a player. And they decided it was too much work to be a player and lease the terminal.
Yep.
Now that's,
no, I agree totally with that.
That. And that's, you know, that comes at a great cost to the state. A great cost to the producers in the state.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, to a great cost to many people that depended upon the port, was Idaho, wherever, for
it's
a shipping point.
Issue. Yeah.
And now I read most recently, well, the traffic is increasing.
Exactly.
Well,
we're guessing there might be 2,000 more trucks.
Well,
good
luck. What did you expect?
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's too bad, but that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's go Vic to Neil.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what Vic's take on Neil is he hated that Neil talked about all the dead wood in government,
mm-hmm.
that he was going to come in and change people, which he did. Very different from when Vic came in from Straub, and people were saying, oh, Republican, Democrat, big change. And Vic kept basically everybody. It was very exceptional that he changed
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
Vic also, on that first trade trip, Neil had his own way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a way that Vic saw as working very well with the Japanese
mm-hmm.
and the Taiwanese and things. But Neil's the governor now.
Mm-hmm.
So Vic was... not bitter, because he knows when there's a governor change, there's a change.
Mm-hmm.
But there, he saw there was a real discontinuity.
Mm-hmm.
So, from your side,
mm-hmm.
were you seeing this?
A different style of management.
Uh-huh.
You know, I spent some time talking about Vic's style.
Yeah.
I think the genuine concern and interest was the same on both people's part.
Okay.
I think it's how you do it,
uh-huh.
and Goldschmidt was, you know, he was not a bit bashful about saying publicly, you know, things that would irritate folks, like the deadwood's got to go and whatever. Well, Vic's style of management also was, he had certain agent. I say Vic, Neil's style
mm-hmm.
of management was he had certain agency heads that he depended upon a lot, and he began to create some of the staff type positions in the governor's office
right.
more so than Vic had.
Yeah.
And so it was a different style of management. But I would say that while the style was different, I think the desire for outcome was, you know, equal. Both people,
mm-hmm.
both governors, really had a good sense of the importance of a strong economy to
mm-hmm.
this state.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the importance of a good economy to this, you know, when you're an income tax state.
Yeah.
I think both governors had a real concern and interest in achieving that goal. It's a question of how you get there, and those two, in my my term started with McCall and ended
right.
with Goldschmidt, so I went
right.
through, series of several governors. Those two had a better understanding between what I think is such a fundamental in this state, and that's a good economy means you got resources as a state to do things. Mm-hmm. And both of them understood the business model. I don't know that other governors have understood that as well.
Yeah.
I just don't believe our, that was not the greatest strength of Kitzhaber.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely.
And the jury's out on our current governor.
Yeah.
And so, I saw the difference in style.
Mm-hmm.
I think the basic interests, what's good for Oregon, and the
mm-hmm.
passion that
mm-hmm.
the governors had was
mm-hmm.
probably equal. It's just how you
got there. That's great. Jill, from inside Neil's office, what did you see? Let me tell you what someone told me about watching that campaign in 86. Norma appeared to be running as, if you like what's happened, vote for me. And then she also, on her long expertise in state government.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point she said, I know where the bodies are buried.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the Oregonian editorial board tried to get her to tell them something about those bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I just know where they are. whereas Neil was running as a change agent.
Yeah.
Enthusiasm,
mm-hmm.
Expertise, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
With all the baggage that comes from being the mayor of Portland and
mm-hmm.
the rest of the state and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And after, when people, at the time, when you look at the coverage of Vic, he got us through some hard things, but it's kind of a gray flannel suit kind of guy. I mean, it's like having a CPA as your
mm-hmm.
governor.
Mm-hmm.
So the change with Neil was really exciting. So what was it like inside the office, dealing with that
change? Well, I think when we started out and we were saying that first setting the 100-day agenda,
mm-hmm.
it was hard on the legislature, but it was hard on the staff
mm-hmm.
because you had to gel figuring out where the new governor wanted to go. You had to figure out your new job,
right.
and you had to figure out how to work with people and get it accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it wasn't real clear because it was so frantic.
Yeah.
As an example, I laugh about it. It's the little things that you don't think about. And we went through the big inauguration thing. I was
mm-hmm.
chairman of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, I show up early for work. No one had the key to get into the office.
Just the little things.
It was dark. And none of them had experience in the Capitol building, and we'd been there for a while, so I knew to get security. But then you open the door, and it's still dark, and no one knew where the light switches are.
Yeah.
It was just the basic.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to figure out what's going on in the legislative session.
Right.
You're trying to get them to know the legislators.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to figure out the governor's program and how to implement it. So it was frantic.
Yeah. Yeah. Talking to, I think it was Dan Simmons who was telling me this. He talked about being in meetings with Neil when Neil would just start riffing on things. And it wasn't clear what was supposed to be actionable.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dan says, well, the meetings that he was in, often he was the only one who said, so does this mean you want X, Y, and Z? Trying to nail something down.
Mm-hmm.
Did you experience that kind of?
Mm-hmm. Quite often.
Yeah.
I think that Neil was an impatient leader.
Yeah.
And
impulsive
again.
And impatient, yeah.
Yeah, impatient. He wanted it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, us trying to get to know each other and to know him and figure out how to implement it, it
mm-hmm.
was, chaotic.
Yeah.
It got better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I traveled a great deal. I started out with a job that was called special events or something. That wasn't my thing, but I molded it into, at that time we were trying to implement the regional strategies program,
mm-hmm.
which was the key to his economic development stuff
mm-hmm.
at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And traveling the state because it was the lottery money that went in, and he was driving tourism because he could see the ups and downs of the 80s,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, we needed mm-hmm. tourism to come in.
Yeah.
But to get the counties to work together, how do you get the counties to work together? And I can always, and it had to be more than two. One county couldn't have a regional strategy.
Right.
You had to work with at least one more, and maybe three. Umatilla County worked with Lau and Union. But I can remember, I learned a great deal from Neil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was impatient, but he was so bright.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why he's impatient.
Yeah.
But he says, I couldn't believe it that one county didn't know what the other county was
mm-hmm.
was doing.
Yeah.
And he says, how do you make them work together to make something happen for the state?
Yeah.
And so we were learning to try to make them work together. And this was all going on during the legislative session. He was
yeah.
trying to get the regional strategies program up and going
yeah.
and convince them that tourism was a theory,
yeah.
a strategy for the state.
Fascinating, because now a lot of that would be the Association of Oregon Counties would be breaking down those walls. It would be
yeah.
great to look back at the AOC and see what its role was at that time.
Yeah.
Well, I was the liaison. He appointed me liaison to the counties. Pam Forrester at that time, it was Pam Collins. She
mm-hmm.
was the liaison to the cities. Then he appointed me the liaison to the tribes. And so we were working with those counties, and the most dysfunctional counties were the ones on the this side of the Cascade Range.
Mm-hmm.
So I had it from here down to Klamath Falls.
Yeah.
And to try to get them to work together. So we organized the Eastern Oregon Alliance. I mean,
mm-hmm.
just, okay, you guys, you don't talk to each other. You don't talk to your other Eastern Oregon counties. Leave the Western ones alone. If you can come together and make a solid point of what you want on this side
mm-hmm.
and then drive it and get your economic development dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those are the kinds of leveraging that I learned from Neil.
Yeah.
It's much better to work like this than this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
Yeah. Lottery dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing Ways and Means when the lottery comes in. Jerry tells about Victor really wanting it clear that, by gosh, it was for economic development.
That's right.
Ted Kolangoski says he totally agreed, but as, you know, Attorney General and then as Governor, he's the one who said, well, let's rule it a little bit, you know, expand. So, what did you guys see as the lottery was coming in? Was it supposed to be, you know, people talk about it now as the state's reliant on lottery dollars, and it's like, well, for this much. But is it? Did you see it as a crucial thing when it came in, or were you just kind of trying to set groundwork for what might happen?
Yeah. Interesting question. First of all, if you can define economic development for me,
oh, absolutely.
You know, therein lies the
yeah.
crux of the problem.
The key thing I've discovered is economic development is what was in Vic's head.
There you go. It's whatever someone
yeah.
thinks it is.
Yeah.
However, at the time when it was passed, there was a fairly small amount of money.
Right.
So it wasn't as though if you only got a little bit of money, okay, we'll use it. And I think early on, there was investments in some education,
mm-hmm.
buildings, college, higher ed, maybe, if I'm not mistaken. I don't recall all the details now.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fairly focused, and then as the pot grew bigger, the challenge of defining the use when you had a bigger pot become almost unmanageable.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And unfortunately, in so many ways, what's happened today is where it's now an integral part of the state's budget, whereas before it was always seen as an add-on, some extra money
mm-hmm.
to use for specific economic development projects or activities, now has become a sort of a main portion of the
yeah.
state's budget. And, you know, attorney generals ruled and people concluded and people said, well, if A, B, and C get you here, what's wrong with D getting you a little bit, you know,
right.
the expansion, the growth. And at the time, the transition from Vic's administration to to Neil's, you know, of course, the lottery dollars are growing.
Yeah.
you know, if Vic had had all the money that subsequent governors had, it might have been different.
Yeah.
And so consequently, you know, that's when Goldschmidt thought, well, let's try to block this up and do the regional strategies and get counties to agree upon a sustainable strategy going mm-hmm. forward. You know, he was a master at trying to broker deals using lottery money.
Mm-hmm.
I know of, you know, of the food processing plant, it used to be Krusty's in Pendleton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that deal got to put together because there was some lottery money available to help build access and do some things. And
mm-hmm.
and so in that particular era, the governor's office was able to leverage and use that money. And I think over time, that influence has been dissipated by the legislature plowing more of it into ongoing program
right.
and budget. But, you know, at the crux of the problem, if there's a problem, or the crux of the issue is a better way of looking at it, is help me understand and define what economic development is. And
yeah.
if you can do that,
yeah.
you can, you know, you can tell the Attorney General this is
right.
this is a rule rather than you concluding or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's happened shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. At the very beginning, the notion was, here's a pot of money that this state will use to truly grow at a macro level its economic vitality.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, what's happened is become an essential part of the budget for economic development. Now it's Business Oregon or something.
Yeah.
You know, look at this budget. It's basically lottery dollars.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
and so in therein lies, you know, we're living on it as a necessity as opposed to a
right.
luxury.
The institutionalization of it, in effect, mm-hmm. is needed so that...
Yeah.
It's fascinating that that summer of 84 is when the unitary tax is repealed.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, just that's the section I'm just finishing up.
Mm-hmm.
I had a little question. There was a timing of a memo that didn't make sense, so I sent it off to Jerry and Denny, seeing if they remembered. And I got back huge responses about John Henderson, the head of economic development, who they did not like at all. And apparently he was not being a team player, and so Jerry put the screws on him as the chief of staff. But the fascinating thing is, at some point between about January and then May, the unitary tax, Vic is eventually saying, yeah, we do need to get rid of it, but that'll be the next session.
Mm-hmm.
There's a crucial night in late May when Vic, we didn't know that at the time, said we've got to have a special session.
Mm-hmm.
But the conversation changed so that it wasn't, geez, what are we going to do? Because this is giving a giveaway to corporations
mm-hmm.
to economic development.
Mm-hmm.
And that same understanding of economic development is the way the lottery ran its campaign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a connection
right.
there that just sets up the lottery win mm-hmm. in the
mm-hmm.
election that fall.
Mm-hmm.
Economic development, without, once again, defining exactly what that
yeah.
means.
Yeah.
Well, it was kind of defined for economic development, if I remember right, by the company that wanted to get their machines
exactly.
into Oregon.
Exactly.
I mean, how do we get the people to pass it?
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. But
so
they're picking up. They're picking up on what's out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just when I teach students, actually, when I talk to groups who should know better, because there's all these, you know, should there be more casinos, that kind of thing. And it's like, you know. The $2 million against that casino, you know that just comes from the other tribe that has
yeah.
a casino.
Yeah.
No one else has given any money to that campaign.
Yeah.
Well, they wouldn't do that. Yes, they do.
They do, they have, and they
won't. You know, follow the money.
Yeah.
People today don't, even people that are, you know, making the decisions don't make the connections.
No.
It
no.
just blows me away. We were talking with a friend over the last few days. We were together with some friends. Remember the discussion came up with, we were talking about old cemeteries, and there was this standard that in order to be buried at an old rural cemetery, there were certain standards
mm-hmm.
that were established by the funeral directors or the,
right.
you know, well, okay, I get the picture. they want the people to be buried according to a standard that has them doing the funeral. And if I want to be put in a pine box and put out here behind the shed, no, you can't do that.
Kind of cut them out of the, yeah, out of the picture.
But it's all about the yeah, politics, and yeah, people get people don't make those connections, in my mind,
yeah,
as well as they yeah should.
It's been hilarious. I mean, writing this book, I started my sabbatical at the end of January.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lost 2 weeks in there because as our governor was blowing up, I wasn't doing much book work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, covering all of that and analyzing it and things. But just watching the Oregonian editorial board on clean fuels
yeah
has been just fascinating.
Yeah.
It's partisan. This is bad, bad, bad. It's like, you know, the money was there to elect the people.
Yeah.
The Democrats gained seats.
Yeah.
They tried to pass it last time, and they didn't quite have the vote because it was close and Betsy Johnson made a difference.
Yeah.
Why is this a surprise to you?
Yeah.
Why is this a surprise?
Yeah.
And now they're still trying to make a big deal out of it, and it may actually be in play. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, you guys, you have to just pay attention to the reality on the ground here.
Yeah.
You can kick your feet all you want, but...
Yeah.
This is not a mystery.
Yeah, no, it's not. No, the it's been pretty obvious to me.
Most people are not interested in history or civics, and it's becoming more so, and so they aren't following it. So we've got reporters that do their journalism class reporting, but they don't dig in and don't have the background to connect the dots.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, one thing, it didn't really play a role in the election, but the Oregonian, we now no longer have a statewide paper.
That's right.
And so that's been such an important part of the state for the last 100 years. And at some point we're going to have an election, and that is going to be a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what it is, but...
Well,
just
because the people here in this county don't read, probably didn't read the Oregonian, but some of them did.
Yeah.
We still read it online.
Yeah.
What makes it even worse, and now I'm going to pump up my thing, we don't get cable TV.
Yeah.
We're out here, we have a satellite dish. You know what our local channels are? Washington State.
Yeah.
We say, everybody, no wonder this part of the state just gets further and further from that side, because they don't know what's going on over there. I mean, fewer and fewer people watch news. That's their fault. But I'm a news freak, and I'm not getting Oregon news.
Yeah. I grew up in Medford, and my dad's first job was running the cable company there in the mid-60s. But it was amazing, because we got Portland stations and San Francisco stations, as well as our stations. And so we had a real regional sense. And then as cable turned into the, you know, a billion channels, it's all cooking and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so, boop, boop.
That's right.
You're just chopped
isolated. That's right. And I just, you know, I have CNN on all the time, but that doesn't help me understand rural and urban Oregon.
No, not at all.
Doesn't help me understand the issues or... what's going on in Medford.
I
used to know what was going on in Medford, because when I worked for Neil, that was one of my, Jackson County was one of my counties.
Part of the beat there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mentioned Pam Forster. My dad worked for the Capitol Press for years.
Oh.
So.
Okay. Yeah. I introduced her to Mike.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
And they were, Neil was the best man, and I was the matron of honor. They've moved back here full time now.
Well, they have.
They sold their house in Salem.
Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that. They've been moving towards that. So.
Yeah, well, he's got Parkinson's.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking a year ago, maybe waiting and buying one of the big condos in Salem that then goes into assisted living. But they changed their mind
and came here
full time.
Yeah.
They've had the house here for 10 years, but
they'd
go in back and forth.
Yeah. So any other big things?
Well, I've talked about, you know, specifically the one area that with economic development showed, you know, his great interest
mm-hmm.
in that. I talked about some of his management style, and I related to the you know, to the help here he provided yeah. with the Eastern Oregon Hospital and the transition, which is, you know, what I was trying to do is characterize how he approached his job as governor and how much detail he went to try to do, you know, the right thing, what I thought was the right thing. You know, I just think that during the time he was governor and some of the challenges the state faced, he was probably, without a question in my mind, the right person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when his term expired and, you know, Goldschmidt came in, you know, it was not a case at all in my mind that Vic Attia did a bad job as governor.
Mm-hmm.
It was another era and a, yeah. you know, and another opportunity. And, you know, the Oregon had labored under some pretty challenging times. And you know, everybody was hopeful of a new mm-hmm. frontier and a new, you know, new opportunity. And I so much enjoyed working with Vic because of his, you know, you knew who you were dealing with at all times. He was so willing to expand his scope and his discussion. A great person and, you know, a great governor.
Mm-hmm.
It would not have been a good time to be a governor.
No.
I think he had to call more special sessions than any. It would be interesting to go back. All I can remember is all the special sessions.
Yeah, he had up until the mid-90s, but I think it's up or beat him.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. 2002, five-session
oh.
year.
Yeah.
See, we were in Seattle.
But,
then.
You know, again to that, if my memory is anywhere close, the special sessions that Vic Attia had, you usually came in, he had a solution in front of you,
mm-hmm.
and you know, so he exercised good leadership, and as opposed to a session where there were loose ends that kept the legislature sort of hanging around spinning and
right.
and again, that was a credit to his
yeah.
way of approaching the problem.
There's an exception to that. January 1982, it's the long session.
Yeah.
I haven't talked to Paul Hannum yet, who was the leader of the Republicans in the House.
Yeah.
But the Speaker of the House, Hardy Myers, Barbara Roberts, sitting on the crucial committees, no one... There was no working with the governor's office before that,
mm-hmm.
which probably means that's why it was
mm-hmm.
37 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't know if you remember, if you met and then everybody kind of went home while the
yeah.
committees did stuff and came back and figured it, but it was brutal.
Yeah.
and so I found out about all this since the last time I talked to Jerry. But that's something I'm really going to drill down is what the heck was going on with
yeah.
that
yeah.
session, because everything else is... You 6 weeks ahead of time, you start
yeah.
doing this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
We meet
that's
9 hours
good,
later, it's done.
That's a good point, and I had kind of glossed over that, and I recall that. I mean, I recall the long session.
Yeah.
I can't tell you that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's got to be on the governor's side,
yeah.
and so just
mm-hmm.
figuring that one out.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the session where he said to the legislature, if you don't do this, I'm going to call you back into a session.
Yeah.
Which he did. I think
mm-hmm.
that was 83.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, you know, but even that session he called back for was actually relatively short.
Mm-hmm.
But that January 82
mm-hmm.
one, just
mm-hmm.
something was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going on. Yeah, Vic talks about his time. I mean, he just loved being governor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he talked to you about this, but at some point in there, he decided he wasn't going back to the rug business.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason was... Because he liked making decisions by himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love you two, but no more group decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm done.
Yeah.
But he talks about the Rajneeshis and the recession.
Yeah.
Those two things.
Yeah.
That was a real tough
yeah.
tough set of things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hope the book is going to have lots of stuff that's never been published before on the Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
Jared's the key. And I'm now finding things that give information no one's, it's ever been published at all.
Yeah.
So that gives me leverage to get everything from Jerry. So,
yeah.
Well, the county clerk, I can't remember her name, she did some stuff when Neil was governor that first year. The county clerk from Wasco County, the Dalles,
mm-hmm.
she dealt with the Rajneeshis a lot, too.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably find her name in the old blue books.
Yeah.
She might be worth an interview.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because she dealt
with
them because it was their county.
Yeah. You know, it may have been that, I know how I reacted, it was such a shock to realize some of the things that they ultimately were doing, like trying to poison people and so on. You know, we sort of naively, you know, thought, well, there's this group of people that have a different lifestyle mm-hmm. and think differently about things that are out here in this, you know, remote area of Oregon, and sort of let them be. But that mm-hmm. was not, as it turned out, there was more of a concern for public safety and their motives. And that's probably what made that, I'm just thinking of what you said, that I'm sure the governor was getting information from security interests and others saying, we got a problem here, and this was sort of foreign to Oregon, and so what do you do without just, you know, putting it on the front page.
Discriminatory.
Yeah.
Remember that there was a restaurant in the Dalles and they sprinkled the stuff in the salad bar and the restaurant never opened again.
Vic never met with them.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
But he saw it totally as a freedom of expression thing.
Yeah.
And also knowing that cults have a life cycle.
Yeah.
And his big concern, because people would write him all the time and say, they've got an armory out there, you got to do something. And his concern was that, and he wrote it in letters and things, he said, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a lot of rifles in the back of pickup trucks driving mm-hmm. around. I'm also worried about mm-hmm. the safety of the Rajneeshis. He divided them between the leaders and what he called the innocents.
Mm-hmm.
And
the brainwash.
Just the balance there, really
mm-hmm.
tough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he told you this, but the night before the 1985 session, so it's his last session, he got suddenly ill, worse than he's ever been sick in his life, even when he was having heart attacks.
Hmm.
And they treated it as an assassination attempt.
Hmm.
And Barbara Roberts has just been elected Secretary of State. She remembers sometime in the 30 days, and it has to be this, Jerry calling her at night saying, you just need to know we took the governor to the hospital tonight. Because, you know, you're just newly elected, but the idea that you're the successor hadn't sunk in. But it's because there's no proof, because you have to get the microbes to match up. And even in the cases in the Dalles, they only were able to identify about 20% of them as being truly from the Seminole.
Hmm.
But they treat it as an assassination attempt.
Hmm.
So just fascinating things. This also made Barbara, when Kate was called back by John from D.C., and people were saying, Barbara, why would she do that? You are the successor. You know, if he decides to do something, there's no governor until Kate is sworn in.
Okay.
You come back. It's your job.
Yeah.
And that's when it really hit her.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Terrible time.
Yeah.
January and February.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry was at some kind of a gathering in Salem, and John was there. This is in January, early February. They realized they'd never had a picture of them together. They've known each other since 75 or something like that. And so there's a picture taken, and John looks great. John looks great. But, you know, she was saying, as she was standing there right at the picture she was taking, she said, you know, I'm angry and I'm sad. And he just got a real hangdog look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Stupid is as stupid does.
Yeah. But you're talking about the journalism, you know, the really good journalism that was done on that didn't ask crucial questions.
Yeah.
The key thing is, so Sylvia was doing all this stuff. Did those people get $116,000 of value out of that? If they did, then what is the story? But that, those questions are never asked.
Never asked.
So it's all behind closed doors now. We'll see if the feds do anything.
Yeah.
But
just now you were talking about the, they are going in and in our time and watching the transition. I can recall my first session, I believe it was the open meetings law was before the legislature.
Yeah.
And
sort of the Nixon fallout?
No, I think it was probably, it could have been. But what I recall was actually sitting down with, you know, with people from the Oregonian. I remember Harry Bodine, remember.
Yeah.
And we had a conversation, like I said, you know, help me understand what's why we need this. What, you know, help me. And here was a case where I think it's fair to say the legislature decision makers valued the experiences and the resource and the input from the media. Today, I don't think you can make that case. You know,
the only thing is, like, Jeff Mapes has institutional memory that nobody except Peter Courtney does.
Yeah, but there's Jeff Mapes. And
Peter Wong is still.
Yeah, Peter is. Yeah. Is he?
He's actually working out of the Capitol Press building
with
kind
that
of a
new
joint
Eastern media, the media conglomerate with
the
Pamplin.
Pamplin's
newspaper.
And the Oregonian. And then the other guy that writes the column in the Oregonian,
Steve Dean.
Yeah.
I recall having breakfast with him. At the Rainbow Cafe in Pendleton, and that's when Hatfield was running for re-election, and Steve Dean was up here doing his story, and he asked me, "Well, what about Mark Hatfield?" You know, I remember saying, "If Oregonians aren't smart enough to re-elect the ranking member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, they ought to have their butts kicked across the Columbia River."
Yeah.
And he quoted that.
That's great. And yet, presaging by just 4 years, the voters in Eastern Washington kicking out the Speaker.
Yeah.
Well,
to this day, we were doing opinion exit polling, and you know, 25% of the people that answered the exit polls thought that George Nethercutt was going to be the Speaker of the House.
Yeah. I don't realize they're electing a freshman who.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, no, Eastern Oregon booted out Al Ullman.
Yeah.
It was fascinating because, you know, Al Ullman, until the Packwood Hatfield duo, that's as powerful as Oregon.
Oh,
man. Just stunning. And Vic was so parochial in the legislature. Really, that 74 campaign and getting into it really opened him up.
Yeah.
Out of Washington County, and the things that he really cared about, like natural resources and stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, didn't really have anything to do with Al Ullman.
No.
You know, not, it was really kind of just a,
yeah, he
a
was
contained
a
thing.
Vic Atillo was a product of his years of running a family business and being a product of serving the legislature.
Yeah.
And that for many years crafted how he approached things, how he managed, you know, the role that various agency heads played, and even friends that were associates or lobby members or whatever that he knew, you know, that, and that's a contrasted style from, from say, a Goldschmidt, who was a foreigner, if you will, in the world, and so, you know, but Vic did, to his credit, you know,
he transcended it,
ability to transcend that and
and
realize that there's a broader world there. You know, we're talking about Al Ullman, and people around here want to know, well, how come somebody said if Ullman gets defeated, United Airlines won't be flying in Pendleton much longer.
And they were right.
They were right.
Did you see that's a case with I think it's the lieutenant governor or speaker of the house or something in New Jersey.
Yeah.
There was a flight from New Jersey to basically 40 miles from his vacation home in South Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when he lost power, the flight was canceled within six weeks. Like, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, we're kind of winding down. You guys continue. Since we're so far from anything, I would like to make you a ham sandwich or a tuna fish sandwich with some potato salad and chocolate chip cookies.
I will have to examine your bread. I have food allergies.
Oh, okay.
So I have to. We'll have to examine that.
What if we don't put it on bread?
Well, that might be a very good idea. Very good idea. Well, I can't have any dairy products of any kind.
Okay.
Most bread has got...
Yeah, okay. No dairy products. Out. Can we put mayonnaise in the tuna fish?
You betcha. You betcha.
Tuna fish or ham?
Tuna fish would be great.
Okay, because I was going to put Swiss cheese on the ham, but you can't have that.
No.
Okay, we'll put tuna fish on some lettuce.
Perfect.
And a hard-boiled egg?
Oh, that'd be delightful.
Pickles? And what kind of pickles do you like?
I'm
sweet
more
of
a sweet pickle kind of person.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So, what kind of a time frame are you working on?
I hope this comes out next year.
Yeah.
But books are books.
Yeah.
And when teaching starts, you know, that's where my energy goes.
So what's journalism? What's your?
I do political science at Pacific University.
Okay.
And I started. I'm an international person.
Okay.
So actually, Vic, when he left office and was doing all his stuff, he has business cards that had his information on one side and it's Arabic on the other side. I'm actually the first person who's able to read it in Arabic and say, yeah, it says what you think it does.
Interesting.
But when I came, I grew up in Southern Oregon, went off, never thought I'd live here again, but re-met one of my high school classmates just before our 10-year reunion and we got married. She was out. And so when I moved back here in 1990, it became pretty quickly apparent that there was really nobody except kind of Bill Lunch who knew West Coast politics and could also then articulate it and make sense out of it in systematic ways.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my first interview with a media group was actually there was a fundraiser. Barbara Roberts was at it for the newly powerful gay community was having a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And the television station, Lon Mabon, told them, don't you go get one of those darn liberals from Portland State.
Yeah.
So they called the University of Portland and get it to me. So that happened, and a year later I was calling the elections on one of the television stations.
Oh, okay.
So the election out here that would make the biggest difference is I'm the one who called... Gordon Smith's win 24 hours before anybody else.
Oh, is that right?
Because that's when half of our voters were doing vote by mail.
Yeah.
They did absentee ballots. I figured out a way to pull it
so
that I could get both.
Yeah.
And cracked it.
Huh.
And so I have lots of friends who were out here working for, it was Channel 6 Coin at that point. They're saying, well, our political analyst says you've won. And Gordon just smiled. Journalists all had to drive like crazy back to Portland, whereas Gordon has gone on his plane.
Interesting. When I left the Senate, state Senate, why, of course, I was, as near as I know, I don't know who the Democrat was ever before me to have a seat. At some point there was, but I remember it's been a long time. And I told the Democrats appointed a filler, and I tell them, well, given that and the fact that he tried to line up with, you know, the party, and that became sort of the script he followed. I said, you know, he won't last a term, and then Gordon was elected, but.
Gordon was discovered by, do you know Dan Levy?
Oh, yeah.
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 But he discovered Gordon and Wes Cooley
at
the same time.
Yeah.
Dan doesn't really claim Wes Cooley anymore.
Well, you know, Gordon, know, we talk about Vic's legislative orientation, his experience there, and he was able to then pretty quickly broaden to become a governor that really understood so much more than what his parochial background might dictate. You know, Gordon never really got his hands dirty, if you will, in my perspective. Mm-hmm. When he was in the state senate, he tried
so fast.
He tried to rise above and stay above the fray, and sort of and you know, that got him. You know, it got him when he ran. He got elected, but his reelection, he, you know, instead of trying to dig into some of the challenges that might have existed in the metro area, whether it's transportation issues or whatever, Gordon wasn't geared to seemingly get down into the to the level he needed to understand what solution and give, you know, not only the appearance but the actual reality of him, you know, digging in and understanding. And you know, poor Pat Amadeo, who spent hours in front of us, part of that was trying to understand.
Exactly.
Tell me what's going on, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it's, but Gordon, unfortunately, and I, you know, I like Gordon. I knew him. I knew him when he was running a processing plant over Weston. I remember some, it was interesting, some, there's a pea growers association, and he was, of course, the processing plant, and he was trying to run a little roughshod over the growers, and I remember a couple of them came down to Salem to see me and wanted some legislation introduced that would make it a little more difficult for him to be so arbitrary in some of the contracts, and he got wind of it, and I said, well, look, you know, I don't like to do this legislation either. Why don't you just go talk to those guys? You know, why don't you go figure it out? What's the issue here? See if you can, you know. Don't drive to the office from town and send your minions out to, you know, talk to these people. They're real.
Yeah.
So it's,
One person I hope I'm able to interview, I was able to interview Earl Blumenauer, but I need to talk to Greg Walden, because he cut his teeth on Vic's 1978 campaign, and also spoke at the memorial service. But I, you know, at the end of the conversation, I just want to ask him, so what do you think about Gordon being the head of the national broadcaster? Was you the broadcaster? Aren't. You know, Gordon doesn't know diddly about the national
broadcaster. No, he doesn't, and, you know, it was sort of... You know, that some would say, I don't know if this is, you know, but some might say that, you know, this is the fellow with a silver spoon in his mouth. And he's,
yeah, when you said, you know, he didn't get his hands dirty, he has the softest hands of anybody I've ever seen.
Is that right? Well, that actually came from this, you'll find, really, my legislative assistant secretary worked for him, and she actually implied that, you know, contrary to your style, Mike, he was staying up here out of the fray.
So remember, there was a special session the day after he was defeated by Wyden in 96, and, you know, he's the president of the Senate. He basically just sat there and moped.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you got things you have to do.
Well,
I think the Ron and Gordo show was a good thing for this thing.
No, that's true. You know, Wyden's an example of a, you know, talk about a person that came from a fairly focused, narrow. And look what he has done. He is so, in my mind, he is very highly regarded here, even though, you know, a Democrat this day and age getting elected from rural Oregon is a challenge, but you'll find many of the people that are somewhat knowledgeable about, you know, producer groups, growers association,
mm-hmm.
people who would never come close to a Democrat,
yeah.
you know, appreciate
yeah.
Ron Wyden
yeah.
and
yeah.
support him.
Yeah, he's done an amazing job of broadening from being mm-hmm. the Great Panther guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now he's got power.
Yes, he has.
And it's amazing, in the minority, he is exercising power,
yeah.
much like, you know, that subversive little group of Republicans in the state Senate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last year, I was talking to him, and I had him out to the university. And every time you ask him a question about policy stuff, he'd talk about, well, I have a bipartisan bill.
Yeah, yes.
And it was partly because he does have bipartisan bills, but partly because he knew he was going to lose his seat
mm-hmm.
as the chair. But it actually looks good for the Democrats to take it back again in 2016.
Yeah.
So he wants to play yeah. with, be
no,
in there, whatever the field is.
Yep.
He wants to be a player.
No, I have high regard for him. I've had some experiences where, you know, in 2008, I started the project to rebuild the rodeo grounds
mm-hmm.
for the Pelman Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just before the economy goes this way and you're trying to raise money from
yeah.
outside sources and locally. What a challenge. And there was some opportunity and some federal appropriations
mm-hmm.
to maybe get some funds. And I never specifically asked Wyden for anything other than to explain what we were trying to do and the dilemma we had.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he made the opportunity happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When Vic would go back, as governor, would go back to D.C.,
mm-hmm.
Apparently Wyden was by far the most welcoming and accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine Packwood and Hatfield at that point are their big, big deals.
Mm-hmm.
But even, you know, the other members of the delegation were, you know, here, talk to my this, that, or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But Wyden would be there at the front door, take you through the outer office, to the inner office.
Mm-hmm.
What do you need? What can I do for Oregon?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's really conscientious.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's, you know, the passing of time and memories it's great that there's an effort to at least try to capture some of the things that
mm-hmm.
you're doing and some
mm-hmm.
few things we've talked about Becca Tia, great governor. Yeah. To this day, McCall is, you know, some of the Californians will remember his comments about coming and spending your money and leave.
Exactly.
I don't know that Vic could be given, or I don't think people see Vic in that context.
No. He just, to the end of his days, he said, God, it was so hard to counter that.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would be in Saudi Arabia, and people would tell had heard that.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So,
all over the world.
Yeah, it was great marketing, but then
yeah.
how do you counter that?
Yeah. yeah.
The speech that he gave for the special session on the unitary tax,
uh-huh.
just reading it a couple of days ago, and he's got like three of his paragraphs are about, there's an attitude out there, we have to change the, you know, our perception of the world.
No, he would never go out on a string and do that.
No. But mm-hmm. also being talked out of blowing up the sign.
Yeah. yeah. You know, I obviously wasn't around, but actually knew one of the people that worked in the McCall administration when they... they tried to blow up the whale.
Oh, yeah?
I guess they had blubber and big chunks in places they didn't want it.
Exactly.
Oh, goodness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
yeah.
So while you're up here, are you Are you headed back today?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
I see. Yeah.
Just turn around and drive back.
Well.
Yeah.
We.
I've actually done the one day to Pendleton several times.
Yeah. Yeah. We've, you know, one of the challenges that plagues rural Oregon is, as we see now as we get older, is healthcare.
Yeah, yeah.
So, tomorrow, you know, I drive to Portland for a fairly significant dental appointment.
Yeah.
You know, you do it as if you're going to get the car and go to town for one here, but you go,
right,
you know,
just
three.
Keep driving, yeah.
Three, depending on how long you make a stop along the way, but it's a minimum of 3.5 hours, but
mm-hmm.
it's probably,
mm-hmm.
or that's what we figure,
mm-hmm.
From here to where we're going.
Yeah, not like construction around the Dalles, because it's
yeah.
frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And so 3.5, 4 hours, you got, that's a, you know, that's a normal working day, and then you do the stuff in between.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, growing up in Southern Oregon, I mean, for us, it was always, Portland started at Eugene.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
just a different world.
Yeah. Yeah.
From there up.
Yeah.
And even, you know, I was thinking this summer it would be really fun, because Vic traveled 250,000 miles
oh, when
he was governor. And so I said, because we have his, cause not only his schedules, we have his minute-by-minute cards he carried in his pocket.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be great to go, wow, you took this trip, and so I could get the local newspaper and say, coming through John Day, anybody who was there when Vic Atiyah came through, I'd love to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
All his trips were from Salem to Portland to Eugene, and then occasionally to Bend.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get down to Southern Oregon once or twice a year.
Hmm.
He'd get out here once or twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're, all he's doing is going up and down the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I, that's not, no.
I think it's warm and nice enough to eat out on the back porch. I don't think it's going to cook us.
Okay.
Good.
So
perfect.
Why don't we move to the back
perfect.
Porch?
You
more water or...
Water is perfect for me.
You can just stay with the water. Okay,
yep.
Bring your glass.
Water's perfect.